Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks, and in about 15 minutes we'll have the story that broke very late night in Ukraine shortly before we came on air, and that is Ukrainian officials saying a deal has been reached between Ukraine and the US on the joint exploitation of Ukraine's mineral resources. We'll have more on that, as I say, in about 15 minutes. We're beginning the programme, though, with a striking announcement from the British Prime Minister today. An increase in defence spending paid for by a major raid on the international aid budget, and all coming just a couple of days before the Prime Minister Keir Starmer is due at the White House to meet a president who has long railed against what he says are the feeble levels of defence spending by European allies. The figures, first of all, within a couple of years, says the Prime Minister, the defence budget will rise from 2.3% of gross domestic product, in other words, the nation's economic output, to 2.5%. And then within 10 years or so, the plan is to get to 3% GDP. There's a bit of a dispute about how much cash that will actually amount to, at least in the short term. But the BBC number crunchers reckon it'll be about an extra $7 billion worth. This will be paid for by slashing the aid budget from 0.5% of GDP to 0.3%. Mr. Starmer said that the threat from Russia demanded a major change.
Putin's aggression does not stop in Ukraine. Russian spy ships menace our waters. Russian planes enter our airspace. Russian cyber attacks hit our NHS. And just 7 years ago, there was a Russian chemical weapons attack in broad daylight on the streets of Salisbury. We can't hide from this.
The Prime Minister said this marked the biggest sustained increase in the defence budget for decades since the end of the Cold War, and he framed it as a generational challenge for the whole of Europe. It was a theme picked up by the man who's due to become Germany's new Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, speaking just after his party had come top in Sunday's election.
My top priority is to make Europe quickly so strong that we can be independent from the US. I would never have thought that I would have to say something like this on a TV show, but after Donald Trump's remarks last week, it is clear that his government does not care much about the fate of Europe. I'm very interested to see how we will navigate towards the NATO summit at the end of June, whether we will still talk about NATO in its current form, or whether we will have to establish an independent European defence capability much more quickly.
We'll get on to the controversy over how this is all going to be paid for with a cut in the aid budget. We'll get on to that in a moment. First, let's try to work out how big a deal this is and where Britain's military expenditure needs shoring up. Shashank Joshi is defence editor at The Economist.
Well, in historical terms, this is significant because the last time the UK was spending more than 2.5% of GDP was nearly 20 years ago. It was 1995 to 1996. So in that sense, this is a big shift. On the other hand, we've coming off the back of 15 years in which defence spending has shrunk, the holes in our budgets have got bigger. And so the fact is that this commitment, whilst it sounds like a lot of cash, will probably be absorbed fairly effortlessly by existing programmes with big holes in them. Things like the submarine programme, the replenishing ammunition we've given to Ukraine, artillery we've given to Ukraine. So this is going to narrow the gap between our stated ambitions, the things we promised to NATO, and what we actually have. It isn't going to result in some kind of big new European army that will fill all the gaps potentially left by America. That's not what's going to happen here.
Give me a sense of where you think the need is greatest then, in terms of, I mean, is it about new capabilities or is it about trying to sort of modernise existing equipment, which may have sort of rather fallen behind?
There's a few really big programmes that tend to hoover up all of the cash, and that's the defence nuclear enterprise, things like the nuclear weapons and the submarines that that carry them. There is the GCAP program, which is a scheme to build a next generation fighter jet alongside Italy and Japan. And of course, there is AUKUS, the future submarine that we're building with America and Australia. And once you account for those, there isn't an awful lot left. And it tends to be a competition between the army, which is in a really poor state, really lacking firepower, has shrunk in numbers, could not put out a full division, and the Navy, which has two aircraft carriers, but needs more planes for them and doesn't have enough frigates and destroyers and other things to escort them and protect them. So the government will have to decide, as part of a defence review that's underway now, hasn't yet finished, as to which of those things it is going to prioritise. Does it just sprinkle the extra cash across them, or does it decide actually we're going to accept a smaller army with less capability, but we'll have a more capable Air Force and Navy? But those are the kind of trade-offs it now faces.
It's a further complication to all this that there are these demands, especially as there is concern about America's position with regard to backing up European defence, that there needs to be a concerted effort across Europe, not just to spend more, but perhaps to coordinate more. And could that complicate the calculations for this British defence review and this extra money?
It does, insofar as you're seeing a serious concern in Europe, across Europe, about America's long-term commitment. And therefore, if you look at NATO's war plans, to make those credible, have all the capability you'd need to fight those plans in reality, countries would need to be spending closer to 3% of their GDP on defence. And that is a target that this government has set for the next parliament, not for this parliament. However, if you do that without America present in a post-American Europe, if that is what you think we are headed towards, then you are looking at figures that are north of 4% of GDP. That's a level we haven't seen since the Cold War, and for which I suspect, you know, that would make finance ministries across Europe, including in the UK, sweat very heavily.
And in terms of the threat from Russia driving these calculations, do you think that perhaps one of the lessons of the Ukraine war is that money needs to be spent in different ways?
It certainly is the case that new technologies have shown themselves to be extremely lethal and effective. The most prominent of those is what in the sterile military jargon is known as one-way attack munitions. In other words, suicide drones, strike drones, which in Ukraine now cause the majority of casualties and are increasingly AI-guided. And Western armies just are miles behind Ukraine and Russia in that regard. Also, things like what we call reconnaissance strike networks, recce strike networks. So the ability to find a target, process it, send it to a weapon, and then attack that target all within seconds. However, I will say that the big ticket items are also important. We've seen how, for example, Russian submarines are extremely active in the North Atlantic right now. And therefore, you know, you would want British attack submarines to be able to deal with those. Where I think the government will be asking some questions is perhaps not what it builds, but where it sends things. You know, this year, the British government is due to send an aircraft carrier strike group to the Indo-Pacific region across Asia. And I think there will be some in government asking, reasonably, given the state we're in Europe, is that a great idea? Should we be holding back some of those forces, given they'll absorb lots of destroyers and frigates and other assets? Should we be sending that to the other side of the world, given that Europe is just moving at a dizzying pace?
Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist. Andrew Mitchell is a member of parliament with the opposition Conservative Party. He was the International Development Secretary from 2010 to 2012, the Deputy Foreign Secretary last year. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has said that it was a difficult decision to decide to raid the foreign aid budget to pay for the improvements in defence, but it was a necessary one. How did he respond?
I mean, I'm very strongly in support of what the Prime Minister has said today about increasing British defence and security. I think he's absolutely right. It's something which I think there's broad agreement. The Tories, I think, led on it first in the last Parliament, saying we're going to need to spend more money. But it's quite clear now with recent events that Britain will have to spend a great deal more money. So I'm completely signed up to that. What I think is unwise is to craft a budget to support that which appears to be coming exclusively from the development budget. And I say that for a number of reasons. First, never forget what General Mattis, who was President Trump's first defense secretary, said when Donald Trump wanted to cut aid then. He said, if you cut development spending, I have to order more ammunition. These are two sides of the same coin. The thing that the development budget, when it is well deployed, does is it helps to tackle conflict, often at an early stage, as conflict is growing. It helps to ensure that disease doesn't spread too widely. Look at the way in which the British development budget was used to combat Ebola and, of course, COVID. And above all, of importance to British people, it helps address the causes of migration. So if you cut the budget in this way, particularly when so much of it is going on first-year asylum seekers' accommodation costs, you're then going to gravely undermine the panoply of things which make us more safe and secure.
But I wonder if that's part of the argument, that you're talking about a panoply, and Sir Keir Starmer is pointing towards very much the threat within Europe, the threat posed by Vladimir Putin, and the change in the landscape that has been made by Donald Trump. And given that, he has a choice to make, and it's one. I mean, the leader of your own party, Kemi Badenoch, has wrote to the Prime Minister before he made his announcement, saying he should consider whether some of the money spent on development aid should be repurposed.
Well, I don't think she expected them to take so much of it. And remember, it was cut back before by 0.2, and it's now been cut back again by 0.2. I was one of those who led a rebellion in the House of Commons against this, because we'd all promised in our election manifestos for the 0.7. And who was one of the strongest supporters of that rebellion argued in the House of Commons that you shouldn't balance the budget on the backs of the poorest people in the world, none other than Sir Keir Starmer, our Prime Minister. So I'm very dismayed that this decision has been made in this way, although fully supportive of spending very much more money on defence and security.
May I ask you just briefly, one place where Britain has said that it, independent of this, that it is cutting almost all of its aid, and that is to Rwanda, because of what it says today is Rwanda's unacceptable actions over the border in the DRC, backing the M23 rebels in seizing two towns in the east of the country. What do you make of that?
Well, I when I was development secretary, I also cut aid to Rwanda. And restored it before I left office, because I thought that the government thought that that was the right thing to do. I mean, when you cut aid in this way, you have to remember that the cutting of aid doesn't affect the elites in a country, but it does mean that girls are taken out of school, that the perinatal care is damaged. In Rwanda, it means that work on agriculture, which ensures people are fed there and don't starve, suffers. So you know, it's a weapon to be used with very great care.
And that was the Conservative Member of Parliament, Andrew Mitchell. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Coming up on the programme, one of the giants of pop music, Paul McCartney, on why he is behind a campaign to give musicians and all artists more protection from artificial intelligence.
Because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
More on that in about 10 minutes or so. Main story this hour, Britain has announced that it's speeding up plans to increase defence spending 2 days before the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, meets Donald Trump. Much of the money is going to come from the international aid budget. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. Now, has a deal been done between the US and Ukraine over Ukraine's mineral resources? shortly before we came on air. Well, the first outlet to have this story was the Financial Times, the British newspaper and news website, and then others rode in. And the BBC has now also had confirmation from a Ukrainian official. The news comes after what's been a tense couple of weeks over Washington's relations with Kiev. Apart from all the talk from President Trump about Vladimir Zelensky being a dictator who'd started the war with Russia and milked the US of vast amounts of aid, Mr. Trump had also said he wanted Mr. Zelensky to sign up to a deal allowing the US unfettered access to $500 billion worth of Ukrainian natural resources. Well, I mentioned that the Financial Times, the FT, had the story first. Alec Russell is the FT's foreign editor and joins us live from Kiev. Alec, thank you for joining us so late at night. What's your understanding of the terms of this deal?
The terms, if you take the Ukrainian government's perspective for a moment, the terms are considerably better than the terms that Donald Trump had originally tried to impose on them. So they have done a deal. There's no doubt about that. And it seems likely it's going to be signed by President Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, and President Trump in the White House in a week or so. There are two critical things about the terms. The downside for the Ukrainians is that they haven't got any guaranteed security considerations from the US, which is what they've really been hoping for, what critics of the original deal had pushed for. They were saying, look, if we're going to have to sign away the right to some of our minerals, we might at least get a guarantee from America to contribute to our defense. They haven't got that, but they have managed to remove some of the more onerous demands in the original draft, and I think they regard that as a sufficient breakthrough to do the deal, and they hope that this shows good faith to the Americans and that they can then patch up the relationship, which is tremendously important to them.
Yeah, but is your understanding, I mean, it was, from what I understood of what Donald Trump's opening pitch was, I mean, he wanted sort of 100% of proceeds. It won't be all that from future projects.
It will not be. It will not be 100%. And they've also dropped the incredibly contentious figure that they had in the first draft, which was effectively that America had the right to $500 billion in potential revenue from Ukraine's mineral and energy resources. That figure has been removed. No one could understand where the figure came from at all. It totally baffled Ukrainians. I mean, the industry itself is, it's in its sort of early phases of development anyway, so it seemed ludicrous to them.
Right. There had been talk from figures in the European Union that they were sort of quite close to striking some sort of deal on the extraction of mineral resources. I mean, do you think there's any chance that this could cause a little bit of upset in Europe?
I think it will cause some upset in Europe in as much as a number of European officials and politicians had been arguing against the deal and saying to Ukraine that this was sort of an outrageous request by America, that they were indebting themselves without getting anything much in return. The Ukrainians' riposte is, well, 6 or so days of intense negotiations have radically changed the text, and we just need to have this arrangement and relationship with the Americans. In terms of Europe and natural resources, I think you raise a good point there, in as much as if, and it's still obviously a big if, there is at some stage in the coming few months a ceasefire, and then even some form of an agreed settlement, there will be an unholy rush for some of Ukraine's resources and to invest here.
Alec Russell, thank you very much for joining us, the Financial Times foreign editor, live from Kiev. Now, Paris has been undergoing a major transformation as it tries to ditch cars in favour of bikes and become a greener, less polluted city. Cycling rates have soared, but as Anna Holligan now reports, it's also come at a cost.
Paul was leaving work one evening. He was going down the bike lane here.
Corentin Bredeau shows me the place where in October last year Paul Varry was killed. Corentin knew Paul because they'd both volunteered on campaigns to make cycling safer in Paris. What happened to Paul made headlines.
Paul was on the bike lane. A car took that shortcut on the bike lane, ran over his foot. Paul, of course, got angry. He slapped in the front of the car. The car backed up and then ran over him and killed him.
The driver ran over Paul's foot. He banged on the bonnet. The driver backed up and then ran over Paul.
Yet this was not an accident.
The driver has been charged with murder. He says it was an accident. Paul's death in a bike lane resonated with many here.
We all thought it could have been us. Cyclists suffer every day from violence on the road.
In the last few years, Paris has witnessed a cycling revolution. It's put in more than 1,000 kilometres of bike lanes. More than 11% of trips in Paris are made by bicycle, compared to just 4% by car. But bike lanes come in all shapes and sizes, and it's not always clear who has the right of way. Arguments are frequent. Corentin took me out cycling.
So here we can keep going because it's green. Yes. It's a green bike, but this car is about to turn as well.
Yeah.
It's just chaos.
Well, I mean, nobody follows the rules.
Yeah, driving in Paris is like going to the war.
Going to war?
Yeah.
Shami is a 24-year-old midwife who still drives in Paris, but it's hard. Parking spots have been slashed by half. There's a low emission zone. Streets have been closed to cars. It can be stressful.
Car drivers stop when there is a red light, but some bikes, they ignore it.
What do you do when there's a cyclist who's annoyed at you because you're in a bike lane and they hit the bonnet?
I say sorry and I try to move.
You can see where we're sitting, waiting at these lights. There are cyclists going all the directions.
If you want mobility to be more agreeable in Paris, then the car drivers cannot be the only bad guys.
Alexandra Legendre, who works for a motorist lobby group, feels as though the authorities have bent over backwards to accommodate cyclists at the expense of everyone else, and not just drivers.
This aggressivity that you feel in the streets of Paris did not exist before that. Now, as a pedestrian, you're not safe anymore because you have scooters, you have bicycles, and they don't give a damn about road safety.
The Paris authorities acknowledge the need to improve cycling infrastructure and make sure everyone follows the rules. Rémi Ferraud is a socialist member of the French Senate.
La vision, non, ça n'est pas d'éradiquer la voiture.
The vision, no, it's not to eradicate the car because there are Parisians who have cars. But by reducing the space for them, we reserve it for those who really need to use their cars. We want a city that is 100% cyclable.
Back on the streets, Corentin believes Paris will stick with its new direction of travel.
Cycling in Paris is freedom. It's not perfect, but it's a lot safer than it was before. There are so many bikes in Paris that I do think there's no way back.
The fight to get more bikes in and around Paris. That was Anna Holligan reporting. You can hear Anna's documentary, Road Wars, Cycling in Paris, on the BBC World Service programme, Assignment. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, a new album has been released today. You may have to lean in, as they say, to hear it. Sniff was not mine. It was on one of the tracks. It's not, as you'll have gathered, music, just ambient studio sound, representing what the people behind the album claim could happen to original music if artificial intelligence is offered a free rein. More than 1,000 British musicians, including Paul McCartney, Dua Lipa, Max Richter, have come together to release the album, Is This What You Want? It's a protest against the British government's proposed changes to copyright law, which would allow tech firms to use copyrighted material to train generative AI models without controls or fair payment. Paul McCartney explained to the BBC why he thought musicians could miss out.
Just worried about the copyrights not being protected, because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
Well, my colleague Paul Henley has been speaking to Ed Newton Rex. He's a British composer and former AI executive who's behind the campaign. Why choose this form of protest?
It's recordings of empty studios and empty performance spaces. So you can hear people sometimes walking around, you can hear papers ruffling. And the point of this is it's meant to show, you know, what we expect will be the likely outcome if the government's proposals for upending copyright law to favour AI companies come to pass.
What does the government want to do? How would you describe it?
Well, the government wants to change copyright law. It's currently illegal to train commercial generative AI models on copyrighted work, people's life's work, without permission, without a license, without paying for it. And the government wants to reverse that and allow AI companies to train on any copyrighted work that hasn't explicitly been opted out by a rights holder. So it basically shifts, turns copyright on its head, will inevitably end up with huge numbers of people totally missing the chance to opt out, because that regularly happens when you run these opt-out schemes. It will essentially facilitate the mass transfer of value from the creative industries and creators to AI companies.
It's a mighty thing, artificial intelligence, and it has a mighty future. Isn't there a certain inevitability about this?
I mean, I think AI is fantastic in many ways. I'm certainly personally not anti-AI in any way. I think what's not inevitable is legalizing what's essentially the mass theft of IP to allow people to build these models. There are other ways of building AI. You don't need to take the life's work of the countries and ultimately the world's creators to build this. So I don't think that's inevitable.
Ed Newton Rex, the man behind that almost silent album. He was speaking to my colleague Paul Henley. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. Today, several African countries appointed a high-ranking group of former leaders to try to negotiate peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo, with Rwandan-backed rebels on the march in the east and planning, they say, to head all the way across this vast country until the capital, Kinshasa, falls. The M23 rebels have captured two major cities in the east, and already evidence is stacking up of some appalling atrocities having been committed. Survivors of a fire in a prison in Goma in the occupied east of the DRC, in which at least 130 women and 25 children were killed, have told the BBC they want justice, but they don't expect to get it. The fire happened during a mass breakout of more than 4,000 prisoners from the male section of the jail, as Rwandan-backed rebel forces, the M23, were fighting their way into Goma in late January. Survivors have told the BBC they were raped by fellow inmates who came over the wall from the neighbouring block. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, is in the eastern DRC and has been investigating. You may find parts of her report distressing.
I'm just walking into the women's wing, or what's left of it. You can see all around evidence of how intense the blaze was. There are burn marks here on all the walls and lots of ash at my feet. And there are a lot of belongings strewn around here. Piles of clothing, lots of cooking utensils. On the ground I can see a copy of the Bible, and everywhere marks of the flames. You can just imagine what was endured by the women and children who were trapped here, locked in, unable to get away.
Two survivors from the women's prison have come back for the first time. They want to tell their story. In silence, they walk through the charred ruins. 22-year-old Pascaline has her hand to her mouth in horror. Nadine, who is 23, is soon in tears.
Pascaline, can you tell me what happened to you that night?
I was raped by two men. Violently. And passed out. While the second man was raping me, I came to. He told me he would kill me if I tried to escape. I was forced to let it happen, instead of losing my life. The unlucky ones were raped. The lucky ones got out without being raped.
That night, the prison was engulfed by chaos and by fire. Most of the guards long gone. By morning, thousands of the men had managed to break free. But the women were still trapped. Among them, Nadine, who was raped by two men and saw women and children dying around her.
Nadine, can you tell me, how have you been coping since the attack?
When I sleep at night, I see scenes of everything I've seen here coming back to me. I see the dead again, as many dead bodies as I saw here until I got out. Maybe through you, someone can help us find justice, because we've suffered a bad savagery.
Do you have any faith in justice here in the DRC?
I don't, because instead of helping us, they were the ones who closed the door. Instead of opening the door, they let us die like animals in this prison.
I'm just coming into a tent in the grounds of a hospital in Goma. I've come here to meet a 25-year-old woman, Sifa Mohammed. Sifa was badly burned in the fire in the prison. Her right arm is very heavily bandaged. There's a bandage on her left hand. And you can see burn marks on her arm and on her face. She was in prison without being convicted of anything, she says. And she was with her 2-year-old daughter, Esther.
We were woken from our sleep by a fire in the middle of the night. We started to scream, "Fire! Help! We will die in this prison." But there was no one there and the doors were padlocked shut. There were no night watchmen. They had all gone.
Sifa, I'm sorry to ask this question, but can you tell me what happened to your daughter, Esther?
I had her on my back when we wanted to escape. Something fell on her. Was it a bomb? I don't know. She died on the spot.
The full story of what happened in the prison may never be known. Sifa says no one is looking for the truth. She and the other survivors we spoke to have not been contacted by anyone. Not the rebels in control in Goma now, nor the government in Kinshasa, which used to run the prison.
Ola Guerin, in eastern DRC, we did ask the government in Kinshasa for a response to what the survivors had told us. So far, they haven't got back to us. Conservationists are raising the alarm over the decline of vulture populations across Africa. The campaign group BirdLife International says 7 of the continent's 11 vulture species are at risk of extinction. Researchers attribute the decline to mass poisoning, habitat loss, electrocution and illegal trade, particularly in southern Africa. It's an issue that Darcy Ogada has also been looking at. She's based in Nairobi and is the North and East Sub-Saharan Africa Programme Director at the Peregrine Fund, which works to protect wildlife.
Across Africa, there's two big reasons for this. The first one that has been a bit more well-publicised is about poisoning. Poisoning is the number one threat to vultures globally. And in Africa, it's largely linked to illicit pesticide poisoning. It can either be as a cause of human carnivore conflict. So that is not directly targeting the vultures, but it's actually targeting carnivores like lions and hyenas. Another challenge is belief-based uses, because vultures, particularly the old world vultures, only locate carcasses by sight, not by smell. So a lot of people believe that they have this excellent eyesight, which is actually true. So they use the heads because they believe that that will help them see into the future to predict things like gambling, success in some kind of elections, anything that, yeah, would help them predict into the future.
Presumably that's been around for a while. So do you know why things have got worse recently, or is it just cumulative over the years?
In terms of the human-wildlife conflict, I think there's a lot less space across Africa, of course, and globally that's true as well. So you have a lot more conflict between humans and wildlife just for land. In terms of the belief-based use, it's definitely something that has been used, you know, traditionally for probably as long as people have been alive. But there's a lot more illicit trade that is happening, especially across borders, of vultures, because they're becoming so scarce in certain countries, particularly in West Africa, that people are killing vultures, you know, in neighboring countries and importing them into areas of Nigeria in particular, and also Benin, where the trade is really strong for belief-based use, practices with vulture parts.
Am I right in saying that, you know, vultures also are very important in terms of the wider ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. They are definitely nature's cleanup crew. They provide a free service, which is basically scavenging carcasses, and certain species also clean up food scraps around dump sites and abattoirs. So they're extremely important in terms of their effect on ecosystems. They really help to reduce potential reservoirs for disease transmission. We have strong feelings that, yeah, they can actually help to limit disease transmission for other wildlife species, for domestic animals, and even for humans.
And that was Darcy Ogada from the wildlife conservation organization, the Peregrine Fund, speaking to me from Nairobi. Now, if you've got clear skies and even better, a view of the horizon, then just after sunset tonight, if there is still a tonight where you're listening, or if not, over the next few evenings, you could feast on a rare astronomical treat. It's called a planetary parade, an apparent alignment of the other seven planets in our solar system. You won't get another chance until 2040. Dr. Megan Argo is an astrophysicist from the University of Central Lancashire. First off, I asked her whether she was able to see the planetary parade.
I have seen it a few times over we've had most of the planets in the sky over the last month or so. So I have seen it a few times. I've come outside to look for it tonight. It was beautifully clear until about 10 minutes ago, and now it's clouded over.
Right. So what's the trick? Because I guess most people can probably spot Venus, this sort of bright light in the evening sky. Take us from there briefly around the others.
Sure. Yeah, Venus is the most obvious one after the sun goes down. So even when the sky is still light, you won't be able to miss Venus. It's the brightest thing over in the west. If you want to see Mercury and indeed Saturn, if you look down from Venus towards the horizon just after the sun has gone down, you will do better if you've got binoculars, and you will need a good, clear western horizon. So the best vantage point is high up a building or up a hill if you've got one nearby, away from trees, away from buildings that block your view. That's the best way to see Mercury and Saturn both together in the low horizon. And then going the other direction, going up into the sky, so you go round from Venus in the other direction, you'll get to Jupiter again, which is really quite bright. At the moment, is the only thing I can just about see poking through the clouds. And then you carry on round to the left and you'll see Mars. Mars is the one that looks orange. So again, it's hard to mistake Mars for anything else.
Right. I mean, you say it's hard to mistake Mars. I guess it could be, once it gets deep into the evening, though, for the rest of us amateurs, it could be difficult to distinguish some of those bright lights from stars.
The key way to tell a planet apart from a star is that planets don't twinkle and stars do, and that's to do with the atmosphere and the size of the object that you're viewing through it. So if you want to tell the difference, if you want to know for sure whether you've got Mars or Venus, look at Mars or a star, then look and see whether it twinkles. If it's twinkling, it's a star.
Right. Now, I said very deliberately this is apparent alignment, because am I right in saying that, I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer?
It is. There's a lot of people thinking that they will all be in a line across the sky. And technically they are. It's just that line from our perspective here on the Earth looks like a circle. So what we're seeing is we're looking out into the plane of our solar system. So if you imagine a dinner plate with the sun at the centre, the planets orbit the sun. They go around in roughly circular orbits. And as you look out into the solar system from the Earth, sometimes they all appear in the same part of the sky from our perspective. And that's what we're seeing at the moment.
And that was Dr. Megan Argo taking us pretty carefully around the solar system. And you can see it for yourselves over the next few evenings, if you're lucky. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. There was a rather striking change of tone today from the suspended president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, the man who last December declared he was imposing martial law to save his country from plotters within and threats from without, by which he meant the increasingly belligerent North Korea. That attempt to impose martial law only survived a matter of hours before lawmakers forced their way into parliament and voted unanimously to block the president's move. The change of tone I mentioned is that pretty much ever since that day in early December, Mr. Yoon has been stoutly, even ferociously defiant. Today, at the final hearing of his impeachment trial, he apologised. So what might that mean for his prospects? He's also facing a criminal trial over the crisis. And what might it mean for the country, so deeply divided and facing a profound economic malaise at home and great uncertainty abroad? Well, earlier today, a man who might have ambitions to replace Yoon Suk-yeol as president, should he be forced now to leave office, came into the NewsHour studio. He's Ahn Chol-soo, a member of the National Assembly from the president's own party, the PPP. First, what does he make of Mr. Yoon's belated apology?
I think it is sincere, but it is disheartening. I saw a leader who once stood tall now appear vulnerable and defensive.
He faces a charge of insurrection. Do you support, firstly, the idea of a criminal trial for Mr. Yoon?
I'm not sure, because okay. I asked about that to many law professors, and even they are divided.
Yeah, I mean, because some people say, look, he was guilty of a bad error of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not that serious. You know, martial law, it only lasted a few hours. It's not like what happened in 1980 when there was a coup and there was a massacre. And indeed, I mean, the polling suggests that the country is fairly evenly split on whether he deserves even to be impeached. If it is so clear-cut, why do you think that is?
I think it reflects the consolidation of far right. It is a reaction to block Mr. Jae-myung Lee. He is a ruler of the opposing party. But polarization isn't sustainable. So to win future elections, the current ruling party needs to appeal to moderates who don't want extremism on either side.
Which leads me to my next question. If he is impeached, will you run to be South Korea's next president?
It's too soon. It's too soon to discuss candidacy. However, a responsible leadership requires preparation. So I have my own kind of plan B. My plan B focuses on preparing for further strengthening Korea's future, and including top-edge technologies and foreign affairs diplomacy.
But what you have just said, it sounds like a manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you are the man who could bring this very divided country together?
I experienced both the parties.
Mm.
And there's many politicians I know in both parties. So maybe I'm the one who can consolidate and negotiate between parties and expand the people who can vote for us.
I guess, obviously, the much bigger issue here is whether you are the next president or somebody else is. South Korea faces enormous problems. How much peril do you think South Korea is in?
I think we are in a very important point that would decide whether our country would prosper in the future or just drop to the end. So I think President Trump gave us threat as well as opportunity, because he cut the supply chain from China, right? So that would be our chance to supply memory chips and displays second batteries to our allies.
And in terms of the politics right now, how much of a threat do you think that is?
I think the status of Korea remains calm, and it shows resiliency. I think we can be normalized within 3 months. You know, if current president is impeached, we should elect the next president within 60 days. So 2 months. So within 3 months, we will be very stabilized.
I'm Charles Su, Member of Parliament for South Korea, and possibly a candidate for the president. Finally today, Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who tried to save President John F. Kennedy during his assassination, has died at the age of 93. Mr. Hill famously leapt on the back of the president's limousine after Mr. Kennedy had been shot in Dallas, Texas in 1963. He was trying to shield the president from any further gunfire. But John F. Kennedy had already been mortally wounded. Speaking to the BBC in 2013, Clint Hill described that moment.
I was on the running board of the car immediately behind the presidential vehicle. I was on the left-hand side. And all of a sudden, I heard an explosive noise over my right shoulder from the rear. Seemed to be from an elevated position. I then started to look toward that noise, but my vision only got as far as the back of the presidential vehicle. And I saw what happened in the car. I saw the president grab at his throat, and he violently moved to his left. And I knew something was wrong, so I jumped from my position, and I ran toward the presidential vehicle with the intent of getting up on top of the rear of it to form a shield. But when the third shot was fired that hit the president in the right rear of the head, and there was blood and brain matter and bone fragments that came out of the wound, that material went all throughout the car, covered Mrs. Kennedy, the back of the car, and on myself as well. And when that happened, I was just about to get on the car. And then the driver accelerated. As I tried to get up, I had slipped because of the acceleration. I had to take a couple extra steps. I finally got up on the back of the car. And as I did so, Mrs. Kennedy came up in the trunk. She was trying to reach the material that came off the president's head. I got a hold of her and I put her in the back seat. And when I did that, the president fell to his left into her lap because his eyes appeared fixed and there was a severe wound in the upper right rear of his head. I assume that it was a fatal wound.
Extraordinary recollection from Clint Hill, the U.S. Secret Service agent who tried to save President John F. Kennedy during his assassination back in 1963. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.